Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hi, good afternoon, Sarah. Nice to see you again. Nice to talk with you again. We'll have this conversation about our experiences at the Institute last summer. But first, kind of tell us all who you are.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah Klotz. I am assistant professor at College of the Holy Cross, and I'm in the English department. My main areas are rhetoric and Native American studies, and so I'm going to be bringing some of that interest into our conversation today. And how about you, Scott? Tell us about you.
So my name is Scott Ellis. I'm a professor of English at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. I normally teach pre-19th century or pre-20th century American literature. I teach composition as well, although I range up through into the 21st century. This institute was eye-opening, so I'm very excited for this conversation.
So why don't I just start us off with a little bit about the institute that we both got to attend last summer, which was on the topic of transcendentalism and social reform, sponsored by the Thoreau Society and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Really a fantastic learning experience, I think, for professors that maybe haven't gotten to immerse ourselves in our primary texts in a lot of years. But what we did is we went to Concord, Massachusetts for a couple of weeks. We stayed together. We went to different sites that were important in these moments and movements. And now we get to kind of reflect on that experience and think about how it's impacted our teaching and our scholarship.
That's exactly right. That's absolutely perfect. So let's just dive in. I'm interested to catch up with you, Sarah, and what you did. And I'm wondering how we think about the transcendental movements, especially in relation to Native American rights.
Yeah, that's such an important question, because I think part of what we learned so much about at the Institute was the incredible social reform movements that really emerge from transcendental thought. And in particular, today I was just remembering the involvement in major transcendental thinkers in the abolition of slavery, in connecting with John Brown, in helping fugitive slaves to escape from slave catchers, lots of active resistance around abolition. And then you kind of get to the issue of Native American rights, and you don't see the same level of engagement. And in fact, you see those very thinkers like Henry David Thoreau, who are so progressive in so many ways and ahead of his time, he didn't have a lot of progressive views about Native peoples. And so I just wanted to share, Josh Bellin was one of our fantastic speakers at the Institute. He has this really interesting quote that I think really illuminates some of these issues. And what he says is, and this is a quote again from Red Walden, though Thoreau read extensively on Indians, commented on them, and sojourned among them, he remained entirely aloof as their advocate. In sharp contrast to his response to the plight of enslaved African Americans, he never published or delivered a paper on the wrongs the Indians suffered or the rights they were denied. Never recommended a means of ameliorating their condition, never risked personal censure or difficulty, let alone imprisonment, by joining in their cause. Even more troublingly, though Thoreau was capable of recognizing the Indians' common humanity, as in his relatively unbiased portraits from the Maine Woods, which is his 1864 text, his private reflections echo his era's racist beliefs. And I'd like to follow that with just a very brief journal passage from Thoreau around the time that he was traveling with his Penobscot guide in Maine for his later book, The Maine Woods. This is from his private writings. He says, this is Thoreau, who can doubt this essential and innate difference between man and man when he considers a whole race, like the Indian, inevitably and resignedly passing away in spite of our efforts to Christianize and educate them? Individuals accept their fate and live according to it, as the Indian does. Everyone notices that the Indian retains his habits wonderfully. is still the same man that the discoverers found. The fact is, the history of the white man is a history of improvement. That of the red man, a history of fixed habits of stagnation. And so one of the things that I really wanted to kind of bring to our conversation today is that we really need to look beyond your Emerson, your Thoreau, your Alcott, in order to get a better sense of the progressive thoughts on Native rights that do come out of this movement and this time. And I think later in our conversation, I'll return a little bit to the Peabody sisters, who are certainly lesser known, but becoming more and more well known, and how they had really a very different approach to the question of Native Americans in this time.
That's fantastic.
So maybe I can ask you a question, Scott. We can kind of go back and forth. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sure.
So I was wondering if you were able to incorporate any of the texts and the ideas from the Summer Institute into your fall classes.
I was. I wanted to add many more ideas, but my syllabus, my book order was pretty fixed. But I was able to add a few elements to one course in particular, and it was a junior level English major course. It's sort of like a historical survey, and I teach some of the standards, Dickinson and Whitman and Emerson. But one part that really stood out, you mentioned Thoreau, as I often teach his very famous essay, Walking. But after the Institute and listening to Barbara McCaskill talk about William and Ellen Craft and Lewis Hayden's incredible activity in working with the family, and that wonderful anecdote, especially when we took the tour on Boston, the anecdote about him protecting William Craft from the enslavers come and try to grab him, I brought that into class, and I actually started my conversation about Walking not with an introduction to Thoreau at all, but with a picture of the daguerreotype of Ellen Craft cross-dressing as a man, and that's how she and William escaped from slavery. And we had a conversation, and I didn't tell them who the figure was, and so they were wondering, well, who's that man? Who's that white man? What is he doing? And so that led to a fantastic conversation, and then I showed pictures of Lewis Hayden's house, and it led to much different conversation about the essay Walking than I have ever had before. And I teach this very frequently. So that was just a wonderful addition. And I'll just add, we're recording this in the spring of 23. And yesterday, a student who was in my class last semester came up to me in the hallway and said, "Hey, professor, what was the name of that couple that you talked about who escaped from slavery?" And she dressed as a man. So it really resonated. And clearly the students have thought quite a bit about that. And so in addition to, I was also able to teach Frederick Douglass's What to the Slaves, the 4th of July, which was part of our institute. And I often teach the Lowell Mills, sections of the Lowell Offering or other texts. And last semester, I paired that with Herman Melville's Paradise of Bachelors and Tartarus of Maids. But I was able to add conversation about the tour we took of the Lowell Mills, Melissa Pennell's tour and talk, and I took some pictures of the mills that I showed to my students. So it really impacted the class and kind of added some depth to the normal conversations that I would have. So I'm wondering, Sarah, kind of back to you, how did the Summer Institute, and especially immersing ourselves in the geography and the social networks of Concord, how did that impact your understanding of transcendental thought?
I think we're both just really awed and so impressed by how immersive the Institute was. Every day we would hear a lecture in the morning, and then the afternoon was us going somewhere, whether that was to Emerson's home or the replica of Thoreau's cabin in the woods in Walden Pond. As you were saying, we went to the Lowell Mills. So every day we went somewhere. And that really helped me think about transcendentalism in an entirely different way. I had known that these thinkers were talking to each other. It had not really occurred to me that they were walking house to house, not very far, just to see each other. And so when you actually get to do that, it kind of changes your perspective. And I've brought that new perspective certainly to my teaching about this period, where I think we might often think of the canon, something hierarchical where we have to focus on certain texts, or we might think chronologically, well, this happened and then that happened. Both perfectly great ways to design a course. But it got me thinking, what would happen if we instead designed a course as a network, as a group of people that kind of move out from this central space into different places and different political movements? And that's where the Peabody Sisters became really interesting and important to me. And I'd like to talk about them a little bit because I think their texts pair incredibly well, maybe with a canonical text that we might be reading from someone like Emerson or Thoreau. And something that was not entirely clear to me until I really started looking into this is that Elizabeth Palmer Peabody lives to be 90. So she is a contemporary of Emerson and Channing and Thoreau and Hawthorne, very connected with Margaret Fuller and hosting everybody at her home near Boston during the what we usually think of as a transcendental moment, like 1830s to 1850s. And then she comes back in the latter part of the 19th century, which is the area and the time period that I'm really interested in, to engage with new forms of education, new groups of marginalized communities. And I don't think we really consider that the transcendental moment could be going on well into the 1880s if you're following Elizabeth Palmer Peabody as opposed to an Emerson or a Thoreau. So I thought I would just talk a little bit about what that looked like. Megan Marshall did come and talk with us about her great biography of the Peabody sisters. There's three of them. Sophia Peabody ends up marrying Hawthorne, and Elizabeth Palmer Peabody is the oldest. She is the founder of the kindergarten movement in the United States. And then you have the middle sister, Mary Peabody Mann, who marries the educator Horace Mann. This is what Megan Marshall has to say about them. Elizabeth was a powerful influence on the great writers of the era, Emerson, Hawthorne, and Thoreau among them. And she also published some of their earliest works. It was Elizabeth who prodded these newly minted transcendentalists away from Emerson's individualism and toward a greater connection to others. So I thought that was really interesting, and I started to think about this moment in the 1880s. My research is on off-reservation boarding schools, and the first off-reservation boarding school begins in 1878. So this is a huge moment for conversations at the national level about Native American education. And in my work, I often tell this essentially genocidal story of what the federal government decided to do to Native peoples through these off-reservation boarding schools, taking children away from their homes, particularly to take their language and their cultural identity away from them and sort of assimilate them into white American society. And it's really interesting at this moment that Elizabeth Palmer Peabody is doing something else. She's doing something totally different. So she and her sister, Mary Mann, are connected with Sarah Winnemucca, who is a Paiute writer who writes this fantastic text, Life Among the Paiutes. Sarah Winnemucca comes to the East Coast to do kind of a lecture tour, and she stays with Elizabeth Palmer Peabody in Jamaica Plain. And Elizabeth Palmer Peabody becomes her biggest fan and biggest supporter. And so she'll sit on stage with Sarah Winnemucca. She's raising money for the tour. She's a huge part of getting this autobiography, Life Among the Paiutes, published. And Mary Mann is actually the editor of that text. And the reason that they connect, Sarah Winnemucca and Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, across geographies, across many lines of ethnic difference, is through education. And so what I'm really interested in pursuing is this idea that Elizabeth Palmer Peabody gives us another way of thinking about Native American rights when it comes to the transcendental movement. And I hope that some of these texts, for example, Life Among the Paiutes, can become part of what we read when we're thinking about that idea of self-education or the inherent value of the self that's so important in transcendentalism.
That's absolutely perfect. I love your idea about expanding kind of chronologically the time frame of the transcendental movement and reform movements, because I think you're absolutely right. It extends well into the late 19th century. So that's a wonderful connection to your research.
I'm wondering if you would tell us a little bit about, you were just talking about how we're recording in spring 2023. And you were telling me that you have a course on the self in the 19th century. Is that right? And how is that going?
Yes, this is the course that I proposed for the Institute. And the Institute, our 2 weeks completely shaped this course, and it completely changed it. I had set up the course before the Institute, and I essentially threw out that syllabus and put a new one together. This course is in the Honors College. It's for first year and second year students. What's interesting is the various majors and disciplines that the students come from. There's only one student who's an English major in my course, but I have biology majors, business administration majors, psychology majors, computer scientists, elementary education majors, etc. I most of the students have different majors, so it's reaching a wide population at our school of first year and second year students. And the whole idea of the seminar is to try to explore what the self means. You know, what in 2023. How can our students begin to understand the self? And I wanted to pull them away from the 2023 Twitter, TikTok selves and go back into the early 19th century. Expose them to some different ideas and different texts. Some of the texts are challenging, and see what they can make of them. And so far, the course is going very well. The students are engaging with the texts, and it seems to be moving in a great direction. And I could just say, you know, I started in the same way that our Institute started, with some kind of standard transcendental text. I've started with William Ellery Channing's Self-Culture and Orestes Brown's Laboring Classes. Neither text I've taught before in class, but they pair nicely because they're not antithetical, but they approach self and reform in different ways. And we had a very fruitful conversation. We followed that the next week with Emerson's Self-Reliance, An American Scholar. Again, two traditional texts that many of us have taught before, including me. But I want to return to the point that you raised a few moments ago about the networks, because the way I then put my syllabus together was to place different texts in dialogue with each other and see how the self and the ideas of reform, both reforming the self and reforming society, could kind of cross-pollinate each other and at times run against each other and see what the students can do. So for instance, to your point about Native American rights, next week we're looking at texts by William Apus. We're looking at selections about the text by King Philip and parts of his Son of the Forest autobiographical text. We're following that with Margaret Fuller's The Great Lawsuit, which again, we talked about in the Institute. And I'm pairing that with the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, the Declaration of Sentiments. And then we're moving on to Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And here again, I'm going to return, this is a different student population, to the conversation about William and Ellen Craft, try to see if I could continue to add to that because the students found it so engaging. But we're also going to come back to, and using the notes from all the scholars that we encountered, talk about the abolition movement in Concord, show a map of Concord, because many of my students have never been there. And we're, of course, going to talk about the fugitive slave law. So what I'm hoping to do, and what seems to be working so far, is put all of these texts together so students can understand how the exploration of the self is historical. And this moment in the early and then mid-19th century was vital in our understanding of what people thought about the self and social reform. So it seems to be going well so far.
That's so fantastic. And I feel like one of the themes that's emerging from our conversation is the way that the Institute has allowed us to bring new texts into conversation with an amazing amount of context, both geographical and historical, and all that affords. And I'm wondering if I can actually also hear about the digital component of your self-class. How have you incorporated the digital into a course on the 19th century, speaking of networks?
Yeah, this is an important part of this course. And so what I wanted to do is incorporate some digital design into the class. And, you know, I was going through various ways to do this. And what I landed upon, I'm using a program called Sutori, and this is a digital story platform, digital timeline platform, in which students can add information about the texts. And so each week, what student groups will go into the text that we are reading for that week. So next week, it's the text from William Apus. And they pull out quotations. They put the quotation on a digital timeline, it's kind of a storyline. And then they tell the story of our course. They talk about why they think these quotations are important, how these quotations from in each subsequent week build upon and grow from the previous week's conversations. And so my idea here is, as we're exploring the idea of the self and reform in the 19th century, my hope is for students to actually build the story of our class. Normally, I do that as the instructor. I create the syllabus, and that is the kind of narrative framework of the course that we explore together. But I want to give a little more agency to my students to say, okay, look, this is how I normally look at this text. And I do talk about that. But I want to know what you see. What do you pull out from this? And what can you show us? And so at each week, this timeline, the digital timeline, continues to expand. And we can move back in time, we can move forward in time, and they can visually add text and documents and images and even videos. So by the end of the semester, they will have a narrative framework of the course. And coinciding with that, I've returned to kind of an old practice of the commonplace book. So each week, I'm asking students to select two or three quotations that are important to them from the text we are reading. And at the end of the semester, in addition to this broad course narrative, the students will put together their own personalized commonplace book and share it with others and try to talk about how some of these quotations, how significant they are to the students themselves. So rather than me as the instructor kind of imposing, hey, this is important, I'm hoping that the students can take some authority over this and design their own commonplace book for that purpose.
Scott, I think that's such an exciting set of ideas. And I'm actually going to steal that digital timeline for my own classes, because I think it really empowers students to take ownership over the material and their understanding of what they're reading. And that can be so important for a historical period that they might not be familiar with, and to just sort of be curious about it and be able to make all of those layers of meaning that it sounds like this platform allows them to do. So I think that's fantastic. And like I said, I'm definitely going to steal your idea.
there's no stealing when we teach. It's all borrowing and building. And I think the notion of building a storyline or a timeline in your course would work very well for your own courses too, especially if some of the course topics are might not be as familiar to the students, especially if you're talking about boarding schools and Native American reform and Native American rights. So if I could just kind of follow up on the ideas in your research, how can we incorporate transcendental figures into this ongoing conversation about off-reservation boarding schools and Indian education? And I know you wrote a book about this, Writing Their Bodies, Restoring Rhetorical Relations at the Carlisle Indian School. So is that, how are you connecting this with the transcendental movement?
You know, I never would have made the connection before this institute, because as I was kind of saying before, I really think of transcendentalism at its height way earlier than the 1878 beginning of the boarding school policy with the federal government. But in doing some research from the Institute and getting ready for this podcast and for teaching and making these connections, I found out that Sarah Winnemucca, who, as I was saying before, was working with the Peabody Sisters as sort of sponsors, she, at the very moment, or just 5 years after the Carlisle Indian Industrial School is opened, she starts her own school, and she starts it in Nevada, which is where the Northern Paiutes have their homelands. And she begins the school with $350 from none other than Elizabeth Palmer Peabody. And so I'm thinking about this for a next project because I'm really fascinated. Sarah Winnemucca had the idea that education for Native children should be not only bilingual, but multilingual. And this is exactly the moment when Richard Henry Pratt is saying to the federal government, English only. And that's the idea that's really catching on. So I always think about, we have this idea that men are kind of creatures of their own time and they can't think outside of their own moment. And something that really connects the transcendental thinkers with this school is that there's always someone who is saying, no, like slavery is an injustice. I'm going to end it. And even as a huge movement is happening to assimilate Native children, there's this alternative. And Elizabeth Palmer Peabody is a part of it. And Sarah Winnemucca is a part of it. The school only lasts about 3 years, from 1885 until 1888, and it ends up closing for lack of funds. But I can't emphasize enough how important it was that there was a Native woman who also spoke English and had connections with the federal government, offering an alternative to what would ultimately become one of the moral stains, I think, on the United States that we're just now coming to terms with. So I'm very fascinated that the Peabody sisters brought their ideas from the Concord scene all the way into the end of the 19th century, and they were implementing them still, trying to reform sort of a very powerful movement of assimilationist education right as it was picking up steam. My favorite anecdote about this is that Elizabeth Peabody offered to send anyone a copy of Sarah Winnemucca's Life Among the Paiutes from her home if they would give her a dollar to send to Sarah Winnemucca's school. And I just think that's fantastic. It's this 90-year-old lady. She's in Jamaica Plain. She's got all these copies of this book that she helped bring into the world. And she's just mailing them to people for a dollar, which is a lot, right? It doesn't sound like a lot now, but was a lot then. So that's one of the ways that I'm starting to think about these connections, and that the Institute has really allowed me to see the bigger picture of the influence of transcendental thought on social reform long after the kind of big abolition moment has happened.
That's so incredible. You're absolutely right. I mean, the ideas from transcendentalism extend well beyond the normal chronological break. But as you say, these ideas travel westward. And that is just an amazing expansion of thought and reform moving across, and good for Peabody. And it also, once you know, this is yet another text that I haven't read, Life Among the Paiutes, since probably graduate school, and now I definitely need to get into it. And it also raises a possible idea of another institute, the after part of transcendentalism. What happens after? Because it does continue to resonate. It certainly resonates with natural history and the rise of nature writing. But I think you're right. It extends into Native American rights and Native American reform. So good luck with this research. I look forward to seeing what you come up with. That's absolutely wonderful.
Well, Scott, I've had such a nice time talking with you today and reminiscing about our warm summer days in Concord, Massachusetts with old friends and new. And I hope we get to keep collaborating and that this fantastic institute goes on for many more years.
I completely agree. It was wonderful talking with you again, Sarah. Hope to talk again soon.